Thanks for the invite. I stuck this on because it's really loud, the beer chillers back there. And turning off the beer chillers in a rugby club is like turning off the life support machine, I think. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what I do and my background and for the first part, and then get a bit more onto the emerging trends. And it's just been really interesting to hear those last, all that stuff together, actually, from the DVC panel, because it gives me a little bit of confidence that what I have to say isn't just plucked out of the air either, because I agree with you. I think there's some real issues. But it's also heartening to see that it seems Northumbria is in quite a good position, at least, in the moment. So the first thing is who I am. I do a mix of things, and it's incredibly hard to tell anyone really what I do. So the best thing I've ever done, seen someone else do actually, I stole this idea, was a pie chart of who they are. So I'm a mix of, I'm a writer, an interaction and service designer, and I'll talk a little bit about service design later, an academic and researcher, and sometimes I'm an artist, and that's the bit that makes it more than 100% a lot of the time. I work as part of the Omnium Research Group, and we come from the College of Fine Arts in University of New South Wales in Sydney. Came out of a project that the founder of the Omnium project, Rick Bennett, started in 1998, I think. And here, that's how I first came in contact with him. I was still in London, he was in Australia, he's English actually, and he was looking for sort of online mentors for a project. And this is, 10 years ago now. And was saying, you know, I'm seeing that designers, and he came to visit our studio in London, I'm seeing that designers are working kind of different ways to the way that we've been teaching them, or we still are teaching them. And this guy here is Paul Rand. He's a very famous designer. He's dead now. He was a very famous designer. And he had this ethos in sort of 87 where he wrote that design is a personal activity. It's all about the sort of individual. And even sort of went on to say, you know, that group design can hinder the creative process. A little while later, this guy called John Warwicker from a design collective, in fact, called Tomato, who we used to work alongside in London, really had a very different view about the individual's place in society has changed. There's a lot about kind of pluralism, connected activity and identity, all the stuff that now is kind of very trendy, he was saying, I guess, 10 years ago almost. And you know, one of the things is that technology is about not about replacement of anything, but about addition, and that's that added complexity is really hard to deal with. Now in design, that what's really shifted is that kind of collective way of working, and particularly online, a lot of designers, graphic designers and new media designers got involved obviously in working collaboratively online, because they were some of the first people using that technology in that way, building websites and so forth. And so Rick, quite insightfully I think 10 years ago, said, well, you know, there's a real mismatch between how we're teaching and the kind of environment that our designers are going into. So he set up the Omnium project, and initially it was a project with I think about 50, 60 students collaborating online from all over the world to work on design brief. And again, this is something that just seems really commonplace now, but 10 years ago we had to build all the tools to make that happen, and just that sort of social network, that online community, they were kind of around, but they weren't really sort of around in the way they are just everywhere today. And so Omnium has sort of five aspects to it. There's online creative projects still. We look into emerging online cultures, which is kind of part of what I do. There's online technical innovation, and I sort of have long discussions about this. Rick isn't a very techie person. I constantly ridicule him for this. And one of the things was that having to sort of build the technology in order to make it invisible again and get it out of the way so that we could actually do the things that we wanted to do. And this is a theme that seems to come up again and again. It's very easy to end up looking at technology for its own sake. It happens a lot in institutions because It's a very big spend often on a bit of technology. It's often seen that it's the promise that it's going to make our lives just so much better. You know it from everything from your mobile phone through to, you know, some huge virtual learning system, that that's just all lies. It never does make things easier. It just makes it more complicated. The best technologies are the ones that you don't notice anymore. And when I talk about sort of online learning and teaching and all of those things, you know, email is one of those things that's relatively simple in its concept. It's incredibly hard to imagine working without it now. I mean, I could easier imagine not using the telephone than I could imagine not using email now. So much of what we do is run off of it. And yet, for most, it's still a relatively new part of our lives. And so you see certain technologies who become invisible because they fulfill a need that you might have never even known you had, but they become so commonplace, it's just taken for granted. And so I think it's really sort of wary in that context when I'm talking about some technology things to not look at it as a sort of panacea. Online research networks, we have sort of ongoing research communities that are online. I'm not going to really talk about them today apart from to say it's probably the same here. One of the big problems with research communities is research students is that they're mostly all working as well and they're never on campus. And so to actually try and create that kind of, particularly it depends on the subject area, but in some areas, particularly in sort of humanities, which is often it's a sort of solo thing to do a PhD, you're not in a kind of lab or working on a larger project. It's very, very hard to create those kind of research cultures, and online is a really great place for that to happen. And of course, online learning and teaching, there's a whole massive load of online learning and teaching, complete online masters that we do, and I teach on still from Germany. So that's the sort of hub of it, and the projects that we do, I'm going to skip through this a little bit, tend to involve grabbing people from all over the world, mentors, special guests, lecturers, students, and then deliberately mixing them up. And you'll see, as I go through a couple of the projects later, you try very hard to do, I suppose, the opposite thing that you might think, which is to make sure we get everyone from in a team that's from different countries, different disciplines, different languages, all of those things, and put them together. To avoid that whole thing where, you know, all the German students go in one group and all the Chinese students go in another group and deliberately mix them up. I'm going to skip on because I don't, unfortunately, have time to really go through one of the projects in detail. I wanted to kind of just quickly talk about the sort of history of it. So the first project was called a Virtual Design Studio. This was this brief. I think it had 50 students. I could be wrong. Could have been more than that. From all over the world, and that was my sort of first contact with mentoring those students. There was four special guests. Each of us wrote a sort of essay and mentored the students through this design brief that went on for 7 or 8 weeks. Then the first sort of online subject, if you like, was a thing called Graphics and Contemporary Society. So again, students from all over the world. What was then quite interesting is a project where scientists came on board called Visualizing the Science of Genomics. And this was a group of different researchers researching HIV virus, research labs from all over the world. And what was amazing for us is that the kind of process that we had used as designers was very similar to the processes that they were kind of going through in some respects as researchers in this area. What was astounding for us is that they never used to talk to each other. These labs from all over the world, their meeting place wasn't online. It wasn't a kind of any other community other than the pages of journals and academic conferences, which is a sort of incredibly slow process, as I'm sure you all know. And I was just amazed that they didn't share these kinds of discoveries and conversations. So this is a place for them to do it. All we really had to do was change the names of the buttons. You know, things that would be lectures became papers. You know, and it changed the terminology, but the actual kind of process was very much the same of those people collaborating, and it's a really successful project. Then we did a project, a sort of photo media project, called Creative Waves in 2005. The one that was mentioned before with Kenya, called Visualizing Issues with Pharmacies. This is pharmacy students and design students, as well as academic staff and experts working together. And the current one is a collaboration between China and Australia about sustainability. What a lot of those projects then kind of spin off are smaller kind of outreach projects, which really are a bit more kind of practical in a way. The process of all those other projects, those global projects where you've got 200 people from all over the world collaborating together, is often much more engaging than the final outcome. But the final outcome isn't really the important part. It's actually the process that they go through and the kind of experience they have, all the skills they learn through that kind of online collaboration. But it was also important for us to have some practical outcomes. So there's a number of smaller projects that come out of this. The one that's just finished, that Rick's been doing in the Philippines, called Reframe. And it's a group of traditional Filipino embroiderers and a way to try and take those skills and bring them help them earn an income from those skills that were seeming like they were becoming out of date. So Rick's been working with them to create these kinds of massive art installations. So instead of having, it's a classic example of kind of collective action. Instead of sort of one person having to do this, there's over 2,000 of these little squares here. The whole community made these little squares, and produced this massive installation for college in the Philippines. And then people can buy one of these and they just get swapped out and replaced as they get kind of bought, and you can own part of the whole thing. So just to give you a sense of the sort of international flavour of those projects, the very first Creative Waves in 2005 had just over 100 participants, 22 countries. And the thing that gets me is there's 35 colleges and universities from all over the world. None of this is stuff that any of those students get accredited for. So they're all taking part in a project that they're not taking part in because they're going to get some kind of credentials at the end. But they're taking part because of the experience that they have of it. And something I'm going to touch on a bit later, this is a real... this is part of the kind of brewing storm, really, is what's the worth of a university or a university degree. 2007 project was bigger, had 200 participants, 60 colleges, 30 countries. And it's really interesting, you know, the common thing is, what about language? The common language is English. There's no getting away from it. But what's also interesting is, as long as those people can make themselves understood, that's okay. And the nice thing about obviously working online is people can use translation tools, and it's not real time, and they can have a think about what they want to say and all of those kinds of things. And in fact, the Collaborate project is much more dual language, this translator's sort of in the mix as well. Okay, so that's ongoing, that one, and I'll just skip through it. If you want to have a look at anything, go to the Omnium website, and you can have a look through some of their projects in a bit more detail. And most of them you can drop into as a guest and have a look around and things as well. So, that's the kind of background. My role in Omnium is this part. I take part in most of the online creative projects, but I look at the users too, and particularly how the kind of technology and the online cultures kind of mix together and how they influence each other. One of the things I think I talked about this when I was last here, and I like it as a metaphor, I think called slime molds and suburbs, I call it. I haven't lived in England now for 10 years nearly, 9 years. And I notice, particularly in London when I go back there, where there's been a new bit of infrastructure that's been built, usually as part of the tube line or something like that, how London changes and how which bits kind of suddenly coalesce and suddenly they're kind of something that's, you know, it's like seeing your grandchildren or something, or your children, and they seem to have suddenly grown up. There's parts of London I go to that I would never have walked down a few years ago, certainly before I went to Australia, and now it's the kind of cool, trendy place. and then the cool trendy places are the parts that are now sort of crumbling a bit. You'll notice it in in Newcastle. There's a bridge gets built, or a bit of piece of infrastructure gets built, and what happens is this: what were previously suburbs to a city or villages outside of that, sort of, it feels like almost overnight, you kind of turn around and then suddenly they're part of the city now, and they're part of this coalesced form. Slime molds, and I'm sorry if there's a biologist here, I'll probably get this terribly wrong, but slime molds are a kind of mold, and the spores leave certain pheromone trails across the forest floor, and when they, it might just look like nothing, just powder on the forest floor, and then a sort of tipping point happens and they will coalesce into what looks like a kind of single organism, and it will move around that forest floor slowly, but as a sort of single organism, and then dissipate again. And one of the things that terms that I really hate is Web 2.0. I've been in the new media industry for quite a long time, and it's really just a combination of technologies that happen to kind of coalesce in this way. You know, we had a combination of blogging in particular, combination of sort of broadband, combination of faster technologies, some other things like RSS feeds and a few other bits and pieces that allowed, that came together, and they really kind of formed this, what's now known as kind of Web 2.0. It's just such a sort of terrible term because it suggests that the web was anything other than that. The web has always been a place where people have been able to upload stuff. If you knew how to write the code, if you had access to a server, of course, you could always publish things. And so the idea of the kind of web being this space, Web 2.0 being something really new, isn't terribly true, and I think it's a bit misleading sometimes. I think it's a way for people to kind of sell technology sometimes. What is important about it is that the technology, again, hit this tipping point where a number of things became so much easier that it enabled anyone to do it. Blogger enabled anyone to start a blog. It was just a sort of three-step sign-up process, and it was very easy. Because of that, what happens is the barriers really come down. Lots of people who never used to write or publish anything online started writing and publishing stuff online. So you've got a much greater diversity of subject matter online. It then became much more interesting to a broader group of people, and it created this sort of massive snowball effect. So it wasn't the sort of fundamentals of the technology of the web, if you like, in itself. It's just that little kind of barrier of access. And it's about kind of knocking those down that I think is a really important aspect for universities. So there's a bunch of different things going on at the moment that I want to kind of talk about. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I think these are some of the things that kind of add to that brewing storm. One of them is sort of collaboration and open source projects. These are very sort of bottom-up kind of projects, and they're very powerful. You know, over half of the world's web servers run on Linux. They run open source software. You're seeing Moodle, for example, as another open source project. There's a lot of projects where lots and lots of people working individually for nothing, usually, are contributing to the greater good of something. And it's incredibly hard for large top-down corporate structures, even Microsoft, with all its cash and resources, to compete with some of that. There's a very good it's a little book from Demos, the think tank, called the Pro-Am Revolution. It's free, have a look, it's open source. Have a look online for it. Where they talk about how the sort of professional amateurs, they use really good examples from astronomy, actually, have made advances that professionals, i.e. you lot, that's academics and researchers, professional researchers, haven't made. And Charles Ledbetter talks about this a lot, about he uses the example of kind of mountain biking as well, that mountain bikes were one of these things that actually came from enthusiasts putting bikes together for what they wanted to do, and it took bike manufacturers some time to actually twig that this was a market and then sort of struggle to catch up, and it came from the bottom up, not the top down. That has really big implications for universities in terms of the way they think about research. The long tail, which I'll talk about in a second. Social networks and communities, which I think have a lot to offer in terms of how you structure physical space. And we're just talking about the new building plans and talking about wanting to be able to have a nice space where people can kind of walk around and enjoy themselves and have a sort of, it feels nice, it feels greener kind of place you actually want to be. I think one of the, I know you probably will not feel this, you probably feel that all your classrooms and everything are kind of crammed and you've got too many students. One of the kind of possible dangers, as Peter just talked about, is that in 10 years' time, they might just all be empty. Organisational change is a really big thing. Collective action, sustainability, open public conversations, and creative economy and lifelong learning. All of these different sort of emerging things, are, if you like these, the suburbs going on, and some of them may not coalesce, some of them I suspect will, some of them already are. And I just have this really strong feeling that it's, the chances are that we're so focused on everything else that we're doing as a university, particularly as education is so heavily audited and policied, and policy isn't a verb, but you know what I mean, it's so heavily kind of put through the mill, particularly from government, in this effort to try and kind of find the perfect mix, that you'll turn around and realise that the landscape's massively changed behind your back. So, hello, right. One obvious one's the network society. I think this is out of date now. I'm sure there's easily 80 plus million blogs in the world. 100 times bigger than it was just 3 years ago. That's out of date as well. YouTube serves over 100 million videos a day, and Wikipedia is more popular than many major news sources. This down here, you can see these are mainstream media in blue, and this red stuff are blogs. So these are things that potentially one person from their bedroom could be publishing online that start to push up into kind of mainstream media. So it's not just this kind of funny little niche thing, it's absolutely kind of central to a lot of culture now. Those things affect the physical world. You know, the Jubilee Debt campaign, a large part of it was organised and orchestrated online. Helped force 36 billion of debt to be cancelled. That's not just sort of nerds online, that's really kind of a large amount of money and a large amount of debt relief. You think of things like Amazon or eBay, politics, banking, commerce, there's almost nothing that hasn't been affected. I talked about email before, by that kind of network thinking. So there's a sort of Pandora's box that happens. Once you've got people thinking in a kind of open source mentality, once you've got people thinking in that kind of collective way, once you've got the web, which is this great sort of manifestation, if you like, something you can point to of the fact that we're all interconnected, which has an awful lot to do with issues of globalization and sustainability, it's quite hard to kind of unthink that. And I think that, of course, what then happens is people think, well, how does this then apply to the real world? How can we kind of use some of these things that we've learned? This is Blackboard on the top, Moodle on the bottom. And of course, so what happens is organisations start changing because you've got a whole load of graduates, a whole load of youth entering the market thinking differently. You've got also organisations thinking differently about what they want. It's a restructuring, less hierarchical. Again, another thing I've stolen from Demos because they've done some very good research in this area, called Work in Progress, about organisational change. And they surveyed these FTSE 200 companies, the HR directors, and the top four skills that were asked for were communications, communicating ideas, problem solving, team working, and creativity and innovation. It wasn't people saying, you know, we need more accountants or we need more people trained in this specific skill. These are really quite kind of abstract things. And these are things that sometimes get taught in university, but a lot of the time they don't. That sort of collaborative aspect is problematic in assessment structures in university. You know, you might have got a group assessment, you might have group teaching. In the end, the individual student gets a mark, and it often pits them against their their collaborators as competition. It doesn't really encourage that sort of a collective way of thinking or working. So this is one of the sort of quotes from that. If innovation flourishes within in and across teams, then you need to be able to work within that. And if the formalities of hierarchy are being overlaid with social networks inside organisations, then we need to be able to negotiate our way through them. Teaching new media is a really kind of difficult thing because technology just changes all the time. And I realised even when I was a student that the sort of pyramid, if you like, of education was upside down in that area, that I would be taught something by my lecturers and in a couple of weeks I'd be showing them stuff. And that happens to me all the time now as well, which I quite like. But that whole sort of knowledge pyramid where, you know, the professor is the expert at the top, which in Germany is still very much the case, by the way, the sort of professor's the expert at the top and the students are kind of receivers of that knowledge, is very upside down. It's often more and more upside down, and particularly if you then start teaching and working on online. One of the shifts that I've seen in the last 10 years is it used to be the struggle with teaching online was teaching people how to interact and work online, to start with, to then make that invisible in order to get on with teaching whatever it was is I wanted to teach. Now when I say to someone, go and fill in your profile, I don't have to tell them how to do that or what that means, because they've already done it on Facebook, they've already done it on a million other social network applications. They know all that stuff, and so you can kind of get on with it. And what we've learned, I think, over the years of doing all these projects, from the global projects to our online teaching, is that often it's the process and not the end result that's been the most important thing. It's very much a kind of design way of thinking as well, where there aren't really any necessarily, especially in design education, the end result is not necessarily the point. The whole point is the kind of process that someone's gone through, or how they're kind of thinking as a designer. And obviously if you kind of move into a creative economy, a knowledge economy, all those ways of thinking are becoming more and more important. So I think what's going on now is that knowledge and information, what universities used to be the gatekeepers of, right, used to be the sort of secular priesthood, the gatekeepers of knowledge and information, that stuff's easy to come by now. Not all of it is true, if you like. It's how you kind of deal with that knowledge, how you work with that, and how you connect the pieces together. The really important skills, because you just don't know what the future's going to hold. We're in a state of flux that I don't think is going to sort of settle down again. I think it's always going to be a state of flux. And I think we're going to go back to, I don't feel like this is a kind of renaissance and then where it's going to sort of settle for a while and then something else is going to happen. I just think the future is likely to be this very kind of shifting sounds all the time. So really teaching students a set of skills makes far less sense in terms of sort of specific skills. This is what forms X profession in the future. These are the things you have to learn, because you just don't even know if that profession's even going to exist, even by the time they graduate. So actually teaching them how to kind of navigate that sea of knowledge, all the issues that people have about Wikipedia, about Googling for research, and all of those things, those are really important to teach students about how to kind of navigate that space. I would argue almost more so than a specific subject or discipline. What I find interesting about social networking and sort of online creative collaboration is it teaches precisely those skills, which is about communications and ideas, problem solving, team working, and creativity and innovation. But they also teach good citizenship. They teach that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And if there was one kind of pressing issue in terms of sustainability and sort of climate change and all of those things that are really critical right now, is that kind of mentality is really, really important to instill. Which brings me on to Cradle to Cradle. I don't know if anyone knows this book. It's a very good book about rethinking the way we make things, not just from making something that's recyclable, but actually kind of really changing the way you think about things. And I had one of those network thinking moments where I happened to read two or three books in a row, fairly randomly actually, that also similar things from different angles. And one of the things I realised was that public funding, and you mentioned this, it's the fossil fuel of education. There's less and less of it, and there's not going to be more of it ever. It's just running out. And one of the things to talk about in Cradle to Cradle is the difference between efficiency, this kind of industrial revolution mentality, drive towards efficiency versus effectiveness. That there's a war. There's a point where efficiency doesn't go any further. You can't. Or the gains are really sort of tight. It's really really thin. Really thin, slight, small gains compared to the effort involved. And at some point, you have to kind of completely rethink it and think of effective systems. They use an example of a cherry tree that is incredibly inefficient in a way. You know, all of its seeds fall to the ground and rot, and maybe one or two actually kind of become another cherry tree. But of course, it's not inefficient at all, because all of that then feeds, waste is food. That food feeds everything else. Feeds the other creatures around. It also feeds the tree itself. But in that sort of industrial revolution mentality, the ultimate cherry tree would be a cherry tree that had one cherry, dropped to the ground, and grew another cherry tree, and there was no wastage at all. And then they go on to talk about, you know, the ideal situation is that you're not going to stop people driving. The ideal situation would be a car that cleans the air as you drive it. So the more people that drive, the better things get. And this is the marvellous thing about effective systems, is that one wants more of them, not less. And they have a lot of very real examples of things they've actually done as well, one of which was a textile factory in the States, whose effluent is actually cleaner than their influent. And when the water board came to test the water, they thought their instruments were wrong, because they went through such a great sort of cleaning process. It also meant that the storeroom that stored all the hazardous chemicals was now a staff room, because they didn't need all those hazardous chemicals anymore. So it completely changed the way they worked. And they talk about this quote, whether if the Industrial Revolution is taking place in the societies that emphasize of community over individual. And then I happened to read a book called The Play Ethic straight afterwards, by a guy called Pat Kane. And he talks, as part of my research is about play and interactivity, and that's why it came up. And he was really kind of railing again against the sort of industrialized, this industrial revolution ethos, in which, you know, an individual submission to a routine is what's most valued. And in that situation, so network societies were a disaster. And really, again, saying completely have to kind of rethink things. Now, I think that in this environment, private institutions are kind of quite well placed, because they don't have all the kind of burdens of government. They don't have government money, but they don't have the burdens of then the interference of that government money. And often, as we all know, large private corporations have got more money than governments anyway. What they're well placed for is because they kind of can move quite quickly and quite fast, and they don't have lots of the baggage that public institutions have. That's a real kind of challenge for higher education, particularly from places you might have previously not even thought about. You know, this whole thing with the McDonald's diplomas and things, you know, and declining standards and all of that, and what will it mean if McDonald's offer a diploma that's terrible for our education? I kind of think the question is not that's going to be a sort of decline in standards. I think the real question for higher education is, what if they do it really well? What if they do it better than you? Because, you know, whatever you might think of McDonald's in terms of health, in terms of food, they're not stupid. They haven't sort of grown to be what they are by being rubbish at what they do. And I just think that kind of stuff's going to happen more and more. We were talking before about education coming from employers. The question then for higher education institutions, public higher education institutions, is what's your relevance? And that, I think there is a relevance. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that you're all dinosaurs. I don't believe that at all. But I do think it's a question to constantly ask. because these guys can move much, much faster than you, even the big monsters that they are. Okay. I don't know if people know the long tail. That was a sort of theory put forward by Chris Anderson, who's from Wired, editor-in-chief of Wired. And he realised that, actually, this is a graph of a thing called Rhapsody, an online music store, also Amazon.com. The basic sort of theory of it is physical stores can only have a certain amount of stuff in them. You can only stock your shelves with a certain amount of objects because of the physical space. And so, of course, you try and stock it with all the stuff that sells the best.
That's the thing
here. Online stores can have an infinite inventory because they can just order the stuff on a sort of needs basis. And that's the kind of tail here. So all of this is niche stuff. So you might have something that only sells one. iTunes might only have a track that sells once a week. One copy once a week, but that's a lot of copies. If you think of the kind of amount of subscribers or amount of people who buy on iTunes or on Amazon.com, that niche ends up adding up to a sizable proportion of their income. Part of the problems with higher education and the sort of rationalisation of departments has been that they've lost a lot of diversity. The stuff that doesn't have whatever the threshold is for the amount of students that need to be enrolled in a certain course or in a certain tutorial group for it to be worthwhile, for it to be efficient, means that you go, okay, we can't run that. So they might be, in Australia, for example, I couldn't run a tutorial with less than about, or a class, let's say, with less than about 17, 18 students in it. The average number is meant to be about 20, 22, 23. If it's less than that, it usually gets cut. So that's, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 students who would have taken part in that course, whose income we would have got, but we couldn't because we had to kind of bin it. So that's all of that kind of long-tail income that just gets lost in education institutions, all that kind of niche. The other problem is it makes it a kind of top 20 hit parade of education. I apologise to the business guys. For MBA, anyone, you know, if you look around universities and you look across, they all offer the kind of same stuff. And it used to be that you go to a certain place because, you know, they're experts in this area, a certain place because they had this one professor who was brilliant at this sort of niche. The more you rationalise, the more there's very little distinction between universities because you get the kind of top 20 things. You tune into any radio station, you hear all the same stuff. And actually, you're more likely to end up like that, and that sort of homogenised thing through that kind of process. So the problem is that diversity, those little niches, aren't very economically viable or efficient. So what do you do? Online is one of the ways you can kind of extend that massively. The real problem is about administrating that, and that's stuff that's possible to deal with. You know, if you think about it, if you've got to run a course, I'll take Sydney for example. I've got to run a course in Sydney that's quite niche, and I need to get 20 students for it. I have to get 20 students who are in Sydney. I have to get 20 students that are interested in that subject. I have to get 20 students who are enrolled in the right programs in order to be able to take that subject and get the right accreditation and all of that. And so your kind of marketplace just becomes really tiny. And of course, you might not get 20 students to do it. If, on the other hand, all I need is 20 people from all over the world to be interested enough to take the subject, then it's probably likely that I'm going to be able to do it. The question is, do you stop people from enrolling just from anywhere to take a subject? Do you allow people to do? Do you have to be part of the program? There's other sort of really rubbish administration things. We did a project between Otago University in New Zealand and Sydney University of New South Wales, and one of the big problems was a collaborative project. It was 20 students from their side, 20 students from our side, a lecturer from either side. Their students couldn't access our online library because they didn't have a student number, because that meant they couldn't get in the system. All that kind of stuff that just shouldn't be a problem was. There's no kind of reason for it to be a problem apart from the kind of administrative kind of gunk of that. Okay. So there's some a bunch of converging trends going on. One is the shortage of funding. Okay. Fossil fuels aren't coming back. You can't keep doing more with less. I don't think you can work harder with less. I think I hate the sort of American sound of this, but it is that sort of work smarter thing. It's not even just work smarter, it's really kind of rethinking the way you make things, you make students in education. I don't know if this is so true here. In Australia it certainly is, that the figures are at least double for a lot of universities of international students, of increased dependence on international as well as local student funding. There's kind of real problems with that, because students become customers, and if you've had any experience of being a broadband customer or even being a kind of mobile phone customer, you'll know that the more customers those companies get, the worse their service gets. The more people who, you know, if a broadband service starts off and they're really great and everyone loves them, they suddenly get swamped, and then their customer support becomes lousy, their whole experience becomes lousy. The problem is that the more students you have, the larger your class sizes are, the worse the student experience is, and so forth. You know, that you've got that kind of pinch going on. What then starts to happen is the students have a decreased perception of worth of that education if their kind of contact hours are seeing a kind of lecture in the distance in a crowded lecture theatre, and they think, oh, you know, I'm not going to bother to come in. It's great that their stuff's online. It's great that you can download lectures and listen to the podcast. I think that's really important. I know from being married to a working student, not one of mine, I have to say, my wife's a student still, that it was a real godsend to her to be able to download lectures, download all the material, because sometimes she just couldn't get into it. She has to drive for 2 hours to get to where she studies at the moment in Germany. But there has to be some kind of worth. And in a sense, education institutions are all about reputation. That you've got a degree from Northumbria, that you've got a degree from Harvard, Cambridge, wherever. It's all about reputation. It's of course, there's a kind of process there, and it's what that person's done. But as you'll know from universities wanting to interview their school leavers and not just go on their grades, your qualifications only go so far. Really, you know, want to know what's the sort of person's experience and what do they know. So you've got this kind of problem that students are paying more and more and more, feeling like customers, as you do when you pay for something, feeling like they're getting a service that's worth less and less and less. And at some point, I think students go, you know, all of the stuff that I'm being taught, I don't really feel like I'm getting into the kind of process. I don't really feel like I'm getting to have a kind of good discussion with my lecturer. I can get all of this stuff online anyway, and then most of it's free. Why am I paying X thousand pounds to go to university when I go there anyway, my employer wants to know what experience I've got, what kind of interaction I've had in groups and teams and innovation, which has really got nothing to do with might not have anything to do with what they're teaching me at university. So I think one of the problems is if you kind of hit that crossover point, not only do you have less students because everyone's getting older, it's becoming more and more expensive, but there's a potential for a situation to happen where education becomes more and more expensive and at the same time worth less and less to the people who would be your customers, as it were. And you could see how it could all unravel quite quickly. I don't think that, incidentally, that my experience of my students isn't that that's a particularly great perception of, or correct perception, I've just stood in front of that, perception of university and study. I think it's something that happens particularly in sort of first 1.5-2 years of study. The students have that kind of feeling that they're in university, they should be kind of learning stuff, that they should be kind of being told how to do stuff, the secrets to life. My experience is with undergraduates, it's when they get to third and honours years, but actually that kind of shifts. They have a much better perception of what it is that they're getting out of university. It's not just about being told how to do stuff. The problem is that it's those people in their sort of first year who are the ones you really need to get in there. Your new students, they're the ones who are actually going to be sort of parting with their first bit of cash in the first stages. And if you can't get them beyond that, if they think this isn't worth it, either before they even enter or after a year and a half they drop out because they don't feel it's worth it, if you can't show them the worth of the rest of the experience of being a student and of the kind of more abstract stuff, the less measurable stuff, then that's a real problem. Because they then kind of focus on credentialing. I've had lots of students say to me, how can I do this degree, 3-year degree in 2 years? So we can't. You know, this, we already thought of making it a 4-year degree. You just can't. Yeah, but no, I know I can do it. I know I can do it. And I can see, and this is usually first year students, their perception is, I just need to know all the stuff and then I can go out there and it will all be okay. And in fact, sort of slowing them down and getting to think about the process is really key. So you've got this, I've talked about this, is top 10 efficiency versus the online, the long tail, and that's also a problem because, again, if every university is offering the same stuff, there's no university that doesn't have in their mission statement, by the way, excellence in teaching. I've had a look through kind of a load before I came here. I've never seen a university say we're offering kind of great sports facilities and we want to be one of the leaders in mediocre teaching. And it just doesn't happen. Or we want to be a bit rubbish at research, but we're okay at this. Everyone says excellence in research, excellence in teaching, leading, so much so that it just becomes like new improved. You know that thing on washing powder, new improved, new great taste on food. It just becomes bland. And if you're a student then looking around, if you're going to be travelling anywhere to go wherever you, if you're not going to deciding not to study locally, then that's a real problem. If everyone's just saying the same thing, how do you kind of make a point of difference? And I think one of the things is diversity, actually, which has been the opposite trend in education. And the other thing I talked about was the rate of change, that people can move much faster, both in the organisations that the graduates are going into, and also sort of in other institutions, who are private institutions, privately funded institutions, because again, if the students are paying more and more for their public education, there's also a point where there's no difference between them paying for a private education, a higher education, and a public one. And you know, maybe the free iPod or whatever it is, swings it. I like this because I like it as a sort of monument to learning, but I also like this, there's a kind of other part where it's these books all kind of gone, a sort of fossil of education, a sort of precarious pile of stuff. I think that has a double meaning there. So the challenges are, there's a danger that it's not that you run out of money, it's just that you become irrelevant. And that's what I mean by turning around and suddenly the kind of the market's there. I mean, you just absolutely don't want to become the Betamax of education. And it happens all the time, and just constantly happens with technology. You can't do with... Oh, no, actually, there's one thing I want to say about that, about C-broadcasting. You know, higher education, and education in general, actually, at the moment, is TV. You get a bunch of people to stand in front of a source of information at a specified time and a specified place. It's not a very kind of... you also tell people what they should be watching, what's the great stuff that they should be receiving, if you like. And if there's one thing to learn from what's been gone on in the media industry, is that that's kind of rapidly changed. That people want diversity. You know, it astounds me that Evolution of Dance has been watched 80 million times or whatever it is on YouTube. I think it's it's rubbish. There's other stuff that I gladly watch on YouTube and I spend hours just kind of looking at stuff and think this is amazing. It's that whole kind of niche thing. Actually, once you really look at it, there's an enormous amount of diversity and people like diversity and people like creating their own kind of connections and groups between us and interests between things. Education is very much still that sort of broadcast mentality. And I think that really has to change. Like you can't continue to do more with less. It's just a sustainability issue. And education is changing, becoming more global. And I think that education needs a kind of design or network mind approach, that you're thinking much more in terms of destructuring stuff and allowing structures to form powers autonomously from the people who use them and not dictate what those forms and structures should be. And I also just think that higher education really needs to still is essentially special places for special people, and that really needs to change, open up much more. I think social networks are effective systems because one of the things is, and I think there's a lot to learn from this, I think there's a lot to learn not just in the online space, but there's a lot to learn in the physical space. An individual gets value from their contribution. One of the great things about social networks, one of the things that makes something like Flickr work really well, is that the more people put in, the greater the whole is, the greater the whole thing is for everyone. But not just that, is that they get a kind of personal benefit back from that. Okay, so that these contributions provide values to their peers, but you get something back. In the case of Flickr, it's a free place to share your photos online. But by providing that free place to share your photos online, you create a kind of resource that's much greater than just one person having their photos online. You also create a place where other people can tag your photos, other people can add more value to your photos. I think if you kind of think about that in a wider education context, is how do you create spaces and how do you create environments where it's not just about me coming to university, trying to get the best grades and credentials I can, often in competition with my peers, when it should be in collaboration with my peers, only to sort of get out there into the world and kind of hopefully do better than them. How do you create an environment where it's much more about being able to reflect something back to that, to the users? And that's one of the things that a lot of the success of social networks online has been, is to provide a system, provide a sort of set of conduits in a place where individual gets something by, usually for free, individual gets something by contributing, but their contribution adds to this greater pot, and that the organisation or the service or whatever it is structured in a way that it enables to reflect that kind of value back to the users. So whether it's Flickr, whether it's Last.fm, which is kind of music sharing space. All of these things, what they all have in common is they allow you to find stuff that you never knew was there but you're really interested in. And that's the big power of social networks. Is you'll know if you've ever spent a fortune on Amazon.com of people who bought this also bought this. That kind of few steps you go to, suddenly you find music, you find books, you find information. It's the web, really. It's all of those things that you follow several links and recommendations, and you suddenly find this whole world that you're absolutely fascinated by and you didn't even know existed. That, to me, seems like a really fantastic premise for education. I talked about reputations, everything. You know, the other thing that's probably some things to learn from the online world is that some things like eBay have worked incredibly well based on reputation. eBay is almost nothing apart from a reputation system. And by the way, you can buy a PhD on eBay if you want. The other thing is that online, you know, you've got this public open conversation, and that means that authenticity is really, really important. You can't just say we're really great at X, Y, and Z without actually being it. Because people will out you in this. I won't go through loads of examples, but there are many, many examples of brands online just becoming unraveled because they've said we are the bee's knees at something, and it's turned out they're not. It's the famous ones, the kryptonite locks, bike locks that you can open with a Bic pen, and it just went round, as you probably will know, it went round very quickly. There's a few other really juicy ones. There's quite a good one at the moment, with Monster Cables. This is, I don't know, do you? So this is a website that has, one of the things they have is reviews of universities. So this person saying I was more interested in being at university in Newcastle than the particular institution. Actually, though, from looking through what I read, Northumbria does quite well. Unofficialguides.com, another website. I can't remember where I got this stat from. It's something like 65-70% of Americans, and I imagine it's higher in the youth market, and I imagine it's probably similar in the UK. Research a product online before they buy it, regardless of whether they buy it online or face to face. Now, the first thing I'd be doing right now, my careers advisor at school wasn't that great, particularly in art and design. The first thing I'd be doing right now if I was thinking of going to university is go online, and I would look at the official university website, but I'd also try and find the dirt. Whether it's true or not, it's going to be out there, and that's where the authenticity thing comes along, because you need to have as many people saying, no, that's rubbish, what you said. You know, you need to have kind of 10 people saying, I had a really great experience, for the one sort of person that goes, oh, no, that's really rubbish, my professor gave me bad marks, I hate them, and all that sort of stuff.
And this is quite interesting.
This is a sort of conversation about, again, example, university. This is a German website called Speak Me. I don't know if anyone speaks German here. This is causing controversy in Germany at the moment. It's a website for school kids, and you can give your teachers' grades, and you can give them. You can do it anonymously, which is why it's causing outrage in Germany, because teachers are saying, "Well, that's not fair" and stuff, and all the kids are going, "Yeah, it's fair. You give us grades, we're going to give you grades."
And so they talk about. This is actually the teacher quotes. I don't want to say who did the worst work, but Daniel, that was nothing. So there's all these kind of ridiculous things
that teachers have said. That stuff's not going to go away, and it's only going to happen more and more. Whatever your feelings about it, it's there. It's something you have to deal with. So higher education has to move from this. Old men, I have to say, sorry. I think I counted, it's pretty balanced, well, I say balanced, I think it was, I did a quick count before, I think 9 women to 15 men in here or something like that. 11, no, more actually, 11 women to 15 men. Anyway, you know, UNSW, when I've been to faculty, sort of university board meetings or you know, heads of schools or associate deans meetings, it's still predominantly old men. Sorry. That's going to change. That's something that, you know, even if you're actively trying to change it, that's something that takes time to change, because it's a generational shift has to happen as well. And to something more like this, not
bloody Judson Likely's Evolution of Dart, X7.5 million views.
But more this idea that it's a much, much flatter structure, that education is really, and I think that's the thing we've also learned from our online project, that we aren't really the kind of teachers, it's that shift from the, you know, the sage on the stage to the guide by the side. It's that shift from being, sharing a kind of journey with our students and understanding that we're kind of part of that, and moving from that kind of broadcast top-down model to that kind of open conversation. And not, I said, not because they're new or trendy or new technology, because these things have transformed culture. For better or worse, these things do transform culture. And I keep seeing weird kind of circular references in media to stuff that, in traditional broadcast top-down media, The Simpsons, in fact, is one of the best at doing this, of taking kind of internet memes and then putting them back into the kind of broadcast media. And you just see how many of those things, I could talk about, you know, Sneezing Panda. Have you seen Sneezing Panda? No, honestly, there's quite a few things. There'll be quite a few things that you would have seen online that get sent around that everyone kind of knows. Those things become part of kind of the fabric of popular culture. And it's just as it's hard to imagine a world without kind of email now, there's a whole kind of generation of kids who, if you're about 14, 15 now, you will have pretty much, for your conscious life, if you like, have always known the internet. And so as you kind of move into higher education, the question isn't, you know, well, you know, why are our lectures online? Why, you know, it's, why isn't it? Why isn't our kind of institution engaging with all of this? This is Twitter. I don't know if you guys know Twitter, but this is a sort of... showing connections between people having a kind of conversation. And I talked about, I put the iPhone in here not because it's trendy or new technology, but it's because of what it represents in terms of a way of thinking. Instead of thinking how can we improve existing kind of mobile phones? How can we take what's already there and kind of incrementally improve it again? One of the things that's been interesting about Apple is that they just went, what if we really rethought about what a mobile phone or a mobile device is, and went there instead, and let everyone else fight it out over here, and recreate a new market here. And I think that's one of the challenges for higher education institutions, is that you've got this kind of massive legacy, and it always feels like it's a little kind of chip here and a little shave here, and you're kind of dragging along this kind of legacy. And I think if you can, the more you can make a kind of sideways leap, the better. Because my feeling is that if you don't, other people will. So if you were starting an institution from scratch, if you were starting Northumbria University from now, if someone said, okay, you've got, I can't remember the budget figures now, but here's your budget. What did you say? 200 and... Okay. Nearly 200 million. To do something with, what would you do before it becomes more like this? And so I'll leave you with some questions rather than answers.
One of them is that departments lead to departmental thinking.
I understand it's a bit more decentralised in some places. The biggest problem in higher education is everyone's a professional, everyone's an expert. Everyone who ever sits around the table amongst faculty staff is an expert in their area, and that's makes it very, very hard to have open conversations sometimes. You really need to have sort of deep professional humility to get some of that stuff off the ground, and think about how you can have those kind of encouraged network thinking, joined up thinking, if you like. What would it look like if there were no departments, no faculties, or even fixed degree programs? To really kind of think, well, okay, what if we just taught stuff and we had no structured programs? Maybe it would be a disaster, maybe it would be another way of students start to kind of put together a very different student experience. How would that, you know, affect assessment and all those kinds of things? What if it was the other way around? What if you were starting with absolutely no funding as opposed to a bit but not enough? Sometimes a bit but not enough is worse than having none at all. How would you structure your resources? It would probably make the way you think about classrooms and timetabling very, very different. For example, it would make you think about much more flexible spaces, creating a space that was allowed students to bring their own resources there much more. Right? Every university's got labs full of computers, which were great 5 years ago. Now, a lot of those are empty because all the students got laptops, and it's much more comfortable to sit at home using your laptop doing your work than to come into a sort of grey, horrible room and sit on a kind of grubby computer and use it. So how do you change those kinds of spaces? It might mean that you make spaces that are much more social, much more less like classroom spaces. I didn't really talk about service design that much. One of the things about service design is about thinking of the entire kind of system and not just thinking about the bit that we normally get asked to do as designers. You know, what's the sort of experience, entire experience of the university as a student, as a member of staff, as a visitor, as a client, customer of the university? And I don't just mean the teaching experience. Compartmentalized. Do that in German. From, you know, the social experience, from the research experience. What's it like just the entire experience of being a student here? And where does the reality depart from the rhetoric? And what if you really did teach globally? And I don't just mean sort of collaborations with other institutions or kind of having international clients. What if your students weren't just international students who you were kind of bringing here to sit in front of your TV, if you like, your TV channel? But what if all your students could be anyone instead of people enrolled in your programs? So what if there were no timetables, no classroom? I think it's really important to kind of think of those kind of wider questions to jump out of that every day. I know, you know, I'm sort of half academic and half not, and I kind of like it that way, I have to say. But I have spent a lot of time in many, many long, tedious kind of faculty meetings talking about just inane trivia of just the sort of workings of something that's really clearly not important to the sort of big picture. I know how easy it is to get kind of sucked into that. There's a massive amount of administration. There's, in an institution this size, there'll be policy departments who will be just pushing folders full of stuff at you, probably, actually, most of all, as associate deans. But it is important then to try and kind of step aside, I think, and have that conversation in order to deal with some of that kind of quietly brewing storm. I don't think it's all doom and gloom. I think you've got an institution that's full of smart people that's doing pretty well. Everything seems to be going. You've got a really good place to start from. I think it's just important to be aware that there's a whole load of things emerging from the woods. Okay. Thank you very much. I am happy to take some questions. Yeah, I'm a bit scared of taking some questions.
Can I answer in German? Any question? I love the phrase
I think it's one of those things, just to respond to that, that, you know, no one wants to, well, maybe some do, but in general people want to do their job kind of well, and at the best because they want to do their job well, at the worst because they don't want to be fired, because they're as seen as being kind of not essential. It is really easy for departments within the kind of universities, everything from sort of health and safety through to academic and education, teaching and learning departments, to spend a long time, a lot of work putting together kind of policy about something, and kind of just drop it on people. And when you're on the receiving end of that, you get five ring binders on your desk that of all the stuff that you're meant to know about policies and procedures and things, instead of stuff that a system where it makes it easy for you to look that stuff up when you need to know it. It can be really overwhelming. I think there's kind of a lot that can be done on that department, on that sort of part. Also working out what stuff's necessary, what stuff isn't necessary for people to know. There's a difference between being aware that stuff exists and having to kind of know it all. The worst situation with that is if there's too much of it, people will find a way around it. There's a thing, and this comes from government down. There's this idea that if you've got a policy in place and you've got a kind of system of measuring it, and they seem to match up, then everything in between is going okay. But what usually happens is there's the policy, there's the sort of reality of what's going on, there's the paperwork that people fill in, which is very different from that reality. And then those two sides can think, it's all going very well, but actually everyone knows that that's not really the case. I had a classic German bureaucracy moment at the place of teaching. It's just a sort of small local university I teach in. And small thing, a key for the lectern, right? I'd have to get a form from so-and-so, it's really sort of Kafka-esque, I have to get a form from so-and-so, go to another building to get it signed by someone else, come back and get it stamped by someone else, and then finally go to the person who's going to give me the key. And the woman who was the sort of school secretary said, you know what, why don't I just go and get a key cut, we won't tell anyone. So this whole kind of security process was just kind of completely sort of breached, if you like, because it was just a pain in the arse. And people will find their way around it. You think you have to be kind of aware of that in all sorts of areas. I think it's something here it's interesting for me to sort of be living in Germany, having kind of lived in... I lived in Australia for 7 years, now I live in Germany. I've lived in Germany for 2 years. And there's a really good, strong sense of citizenship in Germany. There's quite a strong sense of social responsibility. There's some of it's in law, some of it's... you have to clear the snow or ice away from your front doorstep or your front door area, on the street. By quite early, like 7:30 or something in the morning in Germany. Otherwise, if someone slips, you're liable for it. And it's not one of those kind of health and safety nagging kind of cultures. There's a kind of sense that you know, of course there's sort of antisocial behaviour and stuff like that in Germany, but there is a real sense that you do it because it's the right thing to do. And some of that's clearly been instilled in just sort of German culture. I think it's also one of those things you kind of have to experience, really. And that's why I think working on projects and doing things that when you see the benefits, or you can kind of make the match-up of how your contribution doesn't just help everyone else, but actually helps you again. I think it's about making... I always think citizenship is one of those things that actually has to be kind of egotistical in the end. And I think a lot of those issues of sustainability are really about that. That it's very, very hard to undo, you know, the fact that people want to buy stuff and consume stuff and things. But what you can do is try and make kind of close the loop and make sure that the act of them doing that actually benefits everyone, benefits the system. How you then teach that, I think it becomes a bit more subject specific, or a bit sort of area specific. You know, I can imagine it's slightly different in, I don't know, biotechnology or something, as it is in media, but perhaps it's not. You know, perhaps there's quite a lot of similarities there. But I don't feel it's something you can kind of teach as a sort of, like you can teach information literacy. I don't even think you can teach information literacy like that either, actually, but as a sort of disjointed thing. I think it's something that's really embedded in everything. And I think it has to be. I mean, that's the issue of sustainability, really.
I've got a sense in what you're talking about, the internet, which is of course still an immature medium. If you think back to, so go back 20 years, when there were only two or three TV channels in the country, one of the most powerful things about that is that, I don't know, 25 million people would be watching the same thing. So George Orwell's, you do get some consensus.
That shared culture, yeah.
You get what it seems to be on the web. I've never seen any of that stuff. But what you've got, a lot of fringe groups on the internet, and I just can't see all that coming together to have the influence that you've got at the moment. So how would you build consensus on the web when there's so much crap on them as well, that you've got minority communities on there?
I think part of that's about a different way of thinking. I mean, yeah, you're right. And when the web first sort of started, I remember saying a similar thing, that, you know, there aren't as yet, or there weren't as yet, the genres on the web, but there wasn't really even kind of news and comedy, and so it was just everything all at once. I think that has changed a bit. I think there are sort of genres on the web, and I think there are communities. And I think the one of the things that happens is it remains large minority niches, if you like. So you get this kind of thing going on where, weirdly, you get a lot of people, you know, thousands of people often interested in something you would normally think in your day-to-day life that no one's interested in at all, you know, some really kind of niche, offbeat subject. But that sort of global sort of network, if you like, brings all those people together, and there might just be, you know, one person in every county in Britain who's interested in this very sort of minute thing, but actually once they're kind of all brought, a couple of people, once they're all brought together, and connect with other people in other countries, that's a sizable group of people. Now, that's not a shared cultural experience in the sense that everyone in Britain knows, you know, not the 9 o'clock news sketch or something, but it is a shared cultural experience for all those people in that kind of large niche group. I mean, it's a kind of weird contradiction in that sense. Yet there are other things that happen online that just really tip. That's one of the kind of powerful things. That's one of the really dangerous things for brands at the moment, part of the kind of interconnectedness is that it's possible to track what people are saying about what you said. You know, the blogosphere is one of those things where it's not just about me putting something up on my website. It's also the fact that the sort of blogging platform then pings a whole load of servers and said, this has just been written. And other people who are then looking for that stuff say, oh, that looks interesting, and then they'll write about it. Part of it's a kind of real Me Too culture as well, you know, for making some other comment. But it means very quickly things can fan out very wide, very big, correct information, incorrect information, things that people would prefer to be controlled and kept under wraps. Once they're out there, they're out there. There's just no kind of reeling that back. So there are kind of waves of things that happen online and are kind of shared experiences, and that's what that whole kind of meme thing is, really. Whether it's meaningful or not is I think the important thing is often the thing itself isn't necessarily that meaningful. Sometimes it is, actually information itself, but the process of that happening, I think, is really kind of meaningful, and I think it's still open to see what kind of comes with that.
Just a final thought, you said was really interesting. And a few years ago, I was lucky enough to do some work at the University of Highlands Island, the university. And I've taken on many of the principles that you talked about in terms of the long tailoring, working and drawing 20 or 30 different communities to form a collection. But one of the things that they were told, and I'm guessing it's still the same, that the students who succeeded in that have to know how to learn that. The staff who work well and function very well also have to understand how to engage in that medium of learning. And whilst I think it's an absolutely fascinating challenge in some of the areas like that in my college work, and we've got courses where the professional body measure the amount of hours that the students are in the classroom. So even though we and we do really try to engage in that, you don't get your tick in the box, and somebody will literally count the hours of people who let you through, so you can't get the world. We all face different challenges like that. There's still something around, it's a fascinating piece of research where we see who it points to, who told about that, creative people, and it's that model about the picture of our models, which would be a life of fight, and to even consider the book. It's fantastic to see how we can use and how we can work. But there's still something around how people have to shift from social networking and come back to the first thing to education networking in a very different type of way. Because people have to, someone else, the old men or the old women, also have to legitimize that somewhere else to tick the box that says,
look, I completely agree, and I think that there's a, I think you really put your finger on it right at the beginning, but students have to learn and how to work in that environment, or learn in that environment. And some of them, particularly having kind of perhaps learn how to socialise in that environment. And one of the things is that learning should probably be much more social than it currently is. It's quite compartmentalised, can't say that word today, at the moment. But the staff also really need to, it's not just about kind of learning that stuff. It's not that you go to a kind of, Web 2 seminar and learn all that, about all that technology. You really have to kind of be part of it. Now, I obviously fairly much consider myself reasonable sort of expert in this area, and I've been involved in kind of online stuff for a very long time, really from the start of it, but I still know that the real experts are not even my students, actually, they're kind of younger brothers and sisters, really. But I think you have to kind of be immersed in it in order to kind of really understand how it works. And I think the sort of second point about, what's considered sort of accreditable hours and time and stuff, that's part of the kind of dissonance that's currently going on, and I think it will go on for a while between, and that's got things to do with generational shift as well. In design, for example, it's for a long time it's been the case that if I've interviewed young designers for a job position that I've been offering, I'm much more interested in talking to them and looking at their work, and I'm much usually more interested in looking at their personal work than I am looking at their professional work, than I ever have been in what qualifications they've got academically. And what seems to be happening is that's sort of not just in design anymore. It seems to be happening in a lot of different areas that previously had been, you get your degree and then you go into that profession. Now what's increasingly happening is you get your degree, then you do some professional training and so forth. And so
the whole issue of kind of what, how you kind of assess accreditation and all those things becomes really problematic. And it's not going to go away. And as organisations change, that's not going to go away either.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Daniel,